Hello everyone, this is the Dot Matrix. I'm Sean.
I know.
I'm Justin.
And I'm Sean. Or Justin.
Oh, good thing we do live to tape and we don't edit. It's episode 39, and the last time we did it was a month ago, so we're actually we're better than we have been, so that's not bad.
Yeah.
This is our second in a row here at Chateau Ho.
I was gonna say, like, Casa. Yeah, Casa, Chateau Ho. Chateau Ho sounds better, actually.
Chateau.
You could do that. We might edit that out. Just joking. We don't really actually edit much, I realize, do we? We don't.
Well, it's you're the master hand at that. Ooh, that sounded bad. I'll take your word for it.
Actually, yeah. I can say that I think there was like one time I fixed something, but that's only because the signal dropped or something and something crashed.
Right.
Other than that, it's been pretty much as if we were live.
I remember the one time I said something really inappropriate. I think the very first one. And then we had to redo the first one anyways because I think something happened with the audio and just was totally not working. And
I was like, too bad.
I was relieved.
Oh, really? I was kind of like, oh, it'd be nice if we could have saved that. But yeah. We could never be on the radio. Although, you have much experience on the radio and we talked about that a week ago.
That's right, yeah, but that was a long time ago.
Yeah, you might be a little rusty, but you get it back. But I find that when we do this, we actually, in a way, feel like we are broadcasting live. Like,
it's true.
It's just kind of the way you feel once you know the tape is running, you know?
That's right. So to speak. Well, I have a whole list of things. I should probably put it closer to the mic so I don't keep turning around.
Yeah, let's go through these.
It's funny because I forgot. I have to first say that I just realized since the last podcast, my second niece was born. So
I have to
sort of document that for posterity, that my brother and his wife had their second child, and it's a wonderful bundle of joy, and it changes the whole dynamic. And like, it's funny because you're the oldest and your sister is younger and I'm the youngest. Mm-hmm. And I remember I was talking to a lot of people about sort of siblings, and it was my real concern has always been about sort of sibling rivalry and sibling jealousy, right? Mm-hmm. And wanting to, you know, pay as much attention as I did before Erica was born with Kimberly, and just so Kimberly doesn't feel left out or what have you,
right?
And I was talking to people about this, and there was friends of mine who were saying, who are the oldest, they were like, oh yeah, you know, when my parents had my sister, I was so upset. I didn't understand why they had to, like, I understand you're gonna have a kid, but why have another girl? Like, you have me, right? You know, when you're kids, you don't really think about that sort of stuff. So, and me being the youngest, I was birthed into a family that existed already, right? So, and I don't remember anything until I finally gained consciousness of memory, right? So,
yeah.
But do you remember? I mean, but you,
no.
Krista was like just a year younger, right? So, I mean, that's a really good time frame to not really think about those things, right? I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I kind of like this idea too, is that just being a year apart, it like 14 months actually. I mean, it's pretty quick, like boom, boom, you know. For me, it's always been it's been my sister and I. There was no just me, then she came along. It was just both of us together. So, you know, I mean, I think we were different enough, though, that we didn't really have, like, a rivalry.
Right.
I mean, you know, we had our ups and downs like any other pair of siblings or multiple siblings. But I think being so close in age was nice anyway because, well, I think, you know, you can kind of grasp what you're going through. I mean, I have three cousins that are 3 years apart each. And you know, they have a great relationship, but you also think, okay, well, when one of them is going to junior high, one of them's still in grade 5.
Right.
You know, like that kind of thing. So there is that, when you think of it that way. But for my sister and I, sometimes we were in split classes. Like, you, we were all in class together. So that's were with my sister when I was. So it was still of, oh, yeah, I still think of her as my baby sister in a way. Or my little sister. But as you grew older, it was less of a difference.
Yes.
Like, now I think of her as, I hardly think of her as that. We almost seem, like, obviously the same age, so.
Right. Well, it's funny because I remember when you're younger, and when we're younger, like, you know, when you're in junior high or in high school, or you, it's particularly junior high, I think, you know, like, not to make this leap, but I'm from talking about siblings to talking about relationships, so I understand this is a weird, awkward transition here.
It's okay, but it's not like we haven't had that level of weirdness before, so. It's okay.
But it was, it's interesting because, like, at that age, it's unfathomable to let's say, try to date someone or have a crush on someone who's either, you know, a year older or in a different grade, right? Like, I just remember that was such an odd concept. Although, you know, it happens and not it doesn't happen. But, like, you know, how that 1 year made a big, huge, cavernous difference when you're 13, 14 or whatever years.
Oh, yeah.
But, like,
yeah.
Now we're like 30, and and like at 1 year is like nothing.
Oh, isn't it incredible? I mean, going from, yeah, say for me, almost, I think the biggest transition growing up for me, and I think is because I almost kind of made it such a big deal in my head, like I psyched myself out about it, was going from elementary to junior high. I remember going from grade 7 to 8. Now it's just secondary, but at the time it was junior high. And I was like, whoa, this is a big deal. Like, new school. We spent 7 years at one school.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so we weren't used to, you know, changing environment like that. And then because it was only 3 years to high school, going from there to high school, yeah, it was a change too. But from 7 to 8, for me, I think, was like huge.
Well, and it's such, going from 10 to 11, from junior to senior high, like, it's the same structure, but different school, but going from 7 to 8, from going for one teacher for the whole day, the same group of 25, 30 kids.
That's true.
From 9 to 5 or whatever, 8:30 to whatever the 3 or whatever it was, 9 to 5.
9 to 3, right?
Yeah, something like that. And and going to grade 8, where you didn't have a cloakroom, but you had a locker. You didn't, you know, you have 8 teachers and schedules, and I wouldn't see you every day for, like, the whole day, right? Maybe we'd have one class together. Like,
Isn't that weird?
It's a real change, you know?
That was, to me, now that you mentioned, I didn't even think about this until now, was a big part of it, was not being with you and others all day, every day.
Yeah.
I mean, it was good for us, obviously, because you meet new people, and you learn about time management or schedules, like for the first time ever, right? Getting from class to class, like, I was like, oh God, am I going to make it to class? Am I going to get my locker open? Like, for me, like, just having, like, I never used one of those locks before then, you know? And I was always afraid that I'd be, like, stuck, like, trying to figure out my locker, and everyone's gone to class. Like, that was a huge fear of mine at the time.
Wow. So I just watching you say this and use the
you
word
were looking down laughing the whole time.
No, because because I had a visual, because I just remember you from that time. Yeah. And to now see you at Thurman talking about it and using the word, you had to learn about time management. I just thought it was funny. Oh, it's just a funny juxtaposition.
It's like work speak. So programmed to talk like work terms. Now.
It's true. We are very different these days. I just like, sorry, one of the, we're totally not even going into any of the subjects I was thinking about so far, but this is really interesting because I remember, I tell the story a lot about my big fear about going from 7 to 8. And I really credit it to, in some ways, the foundation of becoming the personality that is me and my personality. It was based on fear, and I don't remember because I remember when we all went, we were in grade 7. We went to McRoberts for a tour of the school, you know, just see the school, right? And I can't remember if it was the whole class or if it was just some of us. I can't remember if we were there or not, but I remember that tour so specifically because I remember how, and I probably told you the story. And I'm going to tell a story and I'm going to ask if you had a similar thought about it, because my thing was I saw those lockers. Those lockers were so damn huge, and I was so short, and such a small little Chinese kid really scrawny and thinking, you know, how many times have you watched those shows on television, like Wonder Years or whatever, and people get stuck in and slammed into lockers.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh my God, I don't want to be one of those kids who gets bullied and gets shoved into lockers. And I don't, whether it was consciously, I think it was partly consciously, but also a lot subconsciously, I made a commitment to myself to kind of blend in. And not to say that I had a bland personality. At least I hope I don't have a bland personality, but that I floated around quite a bit. Of course, we were in French immersion, so we had that French immersion thing to us, right?
Yeah.
But I never felt that I was, I mean, I guess I was Chinese, and people always thought Chinese people were nerdy. So I guess I did have a bit of a nerdy thing. So I wasn't going to be a jock or anything, but I wasn't necessarily, you know, too nerdy or too everything. So I kind of felt, and that's sort of my personality. I sort of get along with a lot of people, and I can empathize with what they're coming from. And I really drill down my personality back to that moment of intense fear and doing what I could so I wouldn't get shoved into lockers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether or not you had a similar impression or experience about that when you were going through that tour or not. Or
I don't remember. I remember going. Like, I remember us having gone there.
Right.
I don't know if I was worried about getting shoved in lockers, but I do have a similar recollection of just thinking like, oh, when we get there, like, you know, there's gonna be people in like grade 10 and they're, you know, like they're gonna be bigger, like,
right,
you know, meaner, whatever. And I thought, oh, you know, it's gonna suck being in the first of the three grades there, you know,
right.
And you know, it was interesting because, you know, a lot of us did meet to go to school that first day. I think we met at my house.
Oh, that's right.
Right?
That's right.
And that's cool, too. And I thought, okay, we're all going as, like, a little pack. You know, we'll just stick together and see how it goes. But, yeah, I mean, that was a huge learning curve. I think it was definitely a fear thing for me, too. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I can give too many specifics from just not remembering, but I just, you know, I thought, oh, okay, well, I was in band in grade 7. So I thought, okay, I'm going to want to do that. And then I thought, well, I should be good. It'll be other around my other musicians. But like you, I thought, well, I'll never be a jock. You know, I'm not going to be like a big drama person,
right,
drama student. So, you know, there's all these, you know, stereotypical routes that you go in, right?
Yeah.
Like when you start experiencing more stuff after elementary school. So I thought, okay, well, just, I think, I just was afraid of, oh, you know, I don't know. I think just making sure that I, you know, like you said, got along with people. Like, we're kind of like Ringo that way. Like, I always say. But it's true. Like, we both kind of, I don't know if it's like blowing our own horn, but.
Go ahead.
I always felt that you and I were kind of along those lines of, you know, empathetic. You know, we could always talk to people. I was really shy, I think, in grade 8, like, especially when coming across new people. You know, when we weren't around each other.
Right.
We're in classes where we didn't know a lot of people. I think that was like, whoa, I was quite nervous. It got better, of course, you know, after a few months, I guess. You know, it started to get better. You started to get used to it.
Right, right.
And plus, we were both really close to home, too.
Yes.
We were walking distance, right?
Yes.
So we'd go home for lunch or whatever.
Yes, classic concentration.
Classic concentration. That's right.
That's what I would watch at lunch when I went home.
Yeah, no, I was like, oh, I know that term. Yeah, that was the game show. Yeah, my mom
Alex
had that on,
Trebek.
Too. Yep. So there, oh, and Pyramid, $25,000
yes,
Pyramid.
Yes, yes. Speaking of Alex Trebek, do you watch any of that Jeopardy in the last couple of days? There was where they had the two most famous contestants score
right
off against that robot or
right
that computer.
I saw ads and I recognized one of the contestants.
Right.
Because I had seen him win a few times and I was like, whoa, that guy's smart.
Right.
Or he just has a good memory bank.
Right.
But no, I haven't caught any of it. It looks interesting.
Well, though. I watched the second and third episode. Vanessa we forgot to watch the first one and she reminded me and we watched the last two.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because like, I still don't quite get, and I missed the first episode, so I think that's when they explained the whole robot thing. And sorry, I keep calling it a robot. It's like a computer. And, you know, and how it recognizes voice. But I just don't quite understand, how does it recognize and it comes with three answers. Like, it's just, I got really confused. And one thing I thought was really interesting is that, like, it's impossible for a human to beat a computer in buzzing in. Like, that thing always buzzed in. If it had, like, a certain percentage of confidence in what he thought the answer was, he would buzz in. He would, a person never beat him. If he was, like, at least, you know, 80% confident in his answer, that machine. So I thought that was a bit kind of frustrating. It was interesting to watch, and there was a lot of buzz to it, right? So, like, I think Jeopardy got the biggest ratings in years, right? So
it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
It's funny with Jeopardy, because, I mean, I watched it with my parents as a kid. But, I mean, after a while, it was kind of like, well, I'm not going to be around at 7:30 every night to watch, you know? Like, right. And it was just like he kind of moved on. But then sometimes, though, you'd just be in front of the TV and it's on. You're I'll watch, you know? I think it's fascinating, but... Yeah, I saw a behind the scenes of it once.
Oh, okay.
Like one of those news magazine shows, I don't know which one it was, Dateline or 60 Minutes or something. And they went behind the scenes of, you know, the when you audition for it or you try out or whatever.
Right, yeah.
And the whole process, like, it's amazing. Like, it's quite fascinating, like, how the whole mechanics of how that whole show is put on.
So it wasn't anything like when Dorothy Sbornak tried for Golden Girls?
No.
Anyways, I had to bring that up. Oh, gosh.
Speaking of Betty White winning the SAG?
Yes.
Huh?
Yes, I was so impressed.
You don't mind the pun? But it's just like... I was like, whoa. Like, we happened to be watching. Like, I had just come home from somewhere. And Elaine had it on. And I was like... And Betty White just went up. And I was like, no way. I was actually really pleased for her, actually.
Yeah.
It's just so, I love, you know what I love about it is how continually astonished she is. Like, you feel that, you get from her, right? It's so genuine. It's not bullshit, right?
It's true. So, there's no value for humbleness and honesty, I think, out there.
I know, huh? But yeah, we should.
Ooh, you know what? That leads us perfect when you talk about honesty.
Yeah.
To Minister Bev Oda.
So glad you brought that up. Okay. I think, you know, if they have the power to overrule any bureaucrats that recommend funding going to a church association or whatever church-backed group, or anyone, doesn't, you know, I was almost kind of semi-pleased it was like a church-backed group that got denied funding. Sorry, that's pretty evil, but I was kind of like, okay, but to me, it's beside the point. You can't, it for me, the whole problem with this whole thing is that she's sketchy, okay? I'm sorry, but she's sketchy. And I think if you denied it once and then a couple months later come out and say, you're right, I did this, you gotta go.
Right.
She should have come clean about it the first time. Like, yeah, they probably would have given her shit anyways. Yeah, there it is. We're watching online right now. I mean, look at that. Not. I mean, okay, fair enough. Like, the whole system seems a little crooked, but I think, to me, that's the whole thing. You can't be, like, denying, and then all of a sudden, you know, it's good she got up and said straight on, unannounced, I did this. But to me, it's past the point of redemption. Like, she should be gone, is my opinion. Well, what do you think?
Well, it's funny. I mean, I guess give a quick context to that is, for those of you who aren't familiar, and we'll put a link up that describes the whole thing. But basically, there's this church consortium called Kairos, which is a consortium of 11 churches. And it's a group, church organizations. And there's a whole slew of them. And they do development work and I believe environmental work and research and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And their funding was denied. Looks like it was in 2009, $7 million for 4 years of funding to do a whole bunch of different things.
Yeah.
And then, like you said, the minister said it was because decision was made because of, it didn't meet, the funding requirements for CETA, which is the Canadian.
Oh yeah. Or what is that?
International Development Agency or something, or Something, I think that's what CETA is. And then, you know, it was clear, like you said, that the bureaucrats did recommend it, and then there was a political decision that overturned it, right?
Which is allowed, right?
Which is totally allowed.
And
that's what the prime minister is sort of saying, like, well, it's the minister's prerogative. She makes the final call. Mm-hmm. No one's denying that.
Yeah, no one. That's the thing. No one's denying it.
And it's funny because when we're looking at this thing online, which is actually on the Kairos website, they have a little bit of a clip from that document where it says, where it's typed in recommendation that you sign below to indicate you not approved a contribution of $7 million whatever dollars over 4 years for the above program. If you read the text above it, because it's a whole one page memo, they've cut it off on the screen that we're looking at. The memo reads about, you know, that we're going to do communications on this decision and all this sort of thing. So just by putting a word not in that one line, mm-hmm. Doesn't make the whole rest of the one pager make sense. So, I mean, it's right. completely obvious that the one page is written as if it was approved.
Correct.
And so like, I just don't understand how anyone would even think you can just write not and make the whole thing, you know, make sense.
Exactly.
and actually, I'm surprised that the vice president and the president both signed it on the same day. Sometimes the paper takes a while to get from one desk to the other, and then it gets to November where Bev Oda signs it.
And that's her writing, correct?
Yes.
Of the knot.
Oh, she admitted that she told that knot to be put there. Whether or not she wrote it herself, okay, I don't know.
Immaterial, I guess.
I mean, it's, as we know, I mean, you could hire someone to kill someone from Law and Order. If you don't pull the trigger, that's still your fault. You're still guilty, right?
That's right.
Oh, Law and Order. But anyways, I'm sort of babbling on this. But basically, like, looking at the facts, I mean, why would you, if you're going to change it, you actually should just reprint the document and retype it. You know, like, it's just so sketch all around.
Yeah.
And I was watching, like, The National and the At Issue panel, which I actually do enjoy. It's, like, the best political panel for Canadian politics. And one of the columns was saying, you know, it's not about whether or not the minister lied. It's about that this government doesn't feel accountable. So there is these, I understand, there's these higher themes here. The government is just being totally just cavalier, just saying, we're going to do whatever we want to do. And they don't really care about the rules.
Yeah.
And then someone actually complained about something that I was saying that I actually was noticing myself yesterday. And then, you know, they had all the stuff with the question period, and they were totally, all the opposition parties were asking these questions pointed at Bev Oda, and not once did she stand up and answer them. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know. Like, I mean, there are rules in parliament and question period, I'm sure, mm-hmm. but I just don't understand why is there not a rule that someone asks you a question that if you're sitting there, you should be obliged to stand up and answer that question. Like, why does someone else have to stand up on your behalf? Why does someone else is allowed to do that? But all that being said, I just don't, I mean, there are these hard themes, but for me, it's about the fact that a person has admitted to doctoring or authorizing a doctoring of an official government document.
Yeah.
So all that highfalutin stuff aside and all the opposition parties today are focusing on Stephen Harper and making Stephen Harper the issue about how he lets her stay there kind of thing.
Sure.
I just think, well, that's all smoke and mirrors. Like, you know what I want? I think this minister should just say, you know, that's actually pretty shady what I did. Yeah. And I'm going to resign.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if I'm going to be a human being and a decent human being who should be working in government and being a political leader, elected representative, then I shouldn't be here. Like, if that's how your gut reaction to do that is to do it that way, you know?
If you want to show some integrity at all, you can't. It's weird. It's all these things that keep happening to this government. It's like if it was the other way around, they'd be crying foul.
Because it's not just posture. It's a fact. Like if she didn't want to sign, if she didn't want to approve that $7 million in funding, you know what she could have done? She should have just not signed it. Like, why sign it and then put not? So she actually agreed to it
at one point,
and someone either she changed her mind or someone else made her change her mind. And I guess that's where people start to make links to Stephen Harper, right?
Sure.
But I don't know, like, it's going from bad to worse if she stays silent. She just has to...
Oh, exactly. The more she just sits there and takes it, the worse it looks and it gets. Yeah, no, the opposition parties were quite right to keep pounding on them for this, I think, for like 2 or 3 days in a row or whatever.
Well, and what the panel was saying yesterday, maybe I'll put a link to that. I think probably have it online at the Ad Issue panel.
Because they were
saying how, like, yes, the opposition rallies and says, but at some point, like, but they always let it slide, right?
They always do.
You know, like, they should... If they really were outraged, they should put a motion of non-confidence to the government or vote down the budget when it comes on, and they should force an election. And I think this is one of those outrageous things that, in long-form senses, I think probably, could, in a campaign, really drive a result. And whether or not it would be a majority, I don't know. But I think, like, this is really offensive to most human beings or most Canadians. I think they find this really outrageous. Yeah. And...
Because if this is allowed, then what else are we allowing them to do?
So the opposition are just as, you know, guilty by not making consequences happen, right? Like, they're just neutered themselves. But, oh, well, you know, we all complain, but we'll end up voting for the government on this or that or whatever, right? So, like, if they really were outraged, they should pull the plug on it.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. I think she just needs to go. It's like you go into that role knowing that if you do something like this, you gotta step down. Like, it doesn't mean you have to quit the party. It doesn't mean, you know, you're just not making the 200,000 instead of 100,000. That's what it's about, I think.
It's true. When you're a minister, you do get paid more. That's for sure.
And I think she's like, I like my pay level. I bet you anything that's why she's trying to stick in there.
See, and I didn't know her history, but apparently she's been in like senior vice presidents of like big telecom companies like Bell and stuff.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so I'm assuming those people make a lot more than they do in government. So I was surprised. I didn't know her history at all. I just know she was there.
Yeah.
But speaking of quitting and leaving, I love all these segues, except for the one going from siblings to relationships. At the beginning, stepping down Egypt.
Yeah, well, that's a big one. I mean, this has been going on for since we last podcasted.
Well, yeah, I mean, when we kept saying last week, when we podcast, we have to talk about Egypt. But it seems so anticlimactic now because it's happened like a week ago today. A week ago today, actually, it happened.
Yeah.
And actually, the tide has changed dramatically.
All across the Middle East.
Yeah, now there's all these... you know, little uprisings of protests, which get quickly clamped down differently than what was happening in Egypt. And it really just goes to show, I think, the local circumstances that were there in Egypt and made that possible, made it all that happen. So,
yeah, from Morocco to Iran, basically, and everywhere in between. It's amazing. And I don't know.
Any thoughts?
My thoughts in general are a couple of things. As, you know... It turns out this guy was such a douchebag that he obviously was in power to be rich and stay rich and keep getting richer. People, like regular people, just didn't have access to like basic goods and services that they really need on a large scale. The divide between the rich and poor was... you know, increasing every year. But on the other hand, you had a guy who just ensured that part of the region was stable. There was 30 years gone by of no attacking Egypt. In fact, they worked along Israel. Excuse me. They worked alongside Israel to blockade Gaza, to get rid of tunnels, to keep the Suez Canal clear, even though that just changed because Iran's gone through or will be going through. Like, there's something to be said for that. I mean, the United States and Israel and other major powers liked having this guy in there, you know, and that's why some of them weren't like, He's got to go down. He's got to go. Like, they're very careful with their words, right?
Right.
But, you know, he's 82, probably wouldn't live through another term. He's ill. He was so arrogant about wanting to stay until September. And now some reports say that he had actually ordered the army to stomp down on the protesters, but the army actually refused, which I think is, if that's true, I think that's quite incredible.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, you're right. It could have only really happened in Egypt, I think, because it's still like a secular state. I think there's a lot to be said for that.
Right.
I don't know if they have the men's elevator and the women's elevator like Iran does or Saudi Arabia does. But I think it's a good starting point. I think it's really just the beginning. I kind of compared it to the fall of the USSR, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even though that was much longer in existence, but you know, the time had just come. I think the world's kind of just too open now for this to not start happening. I think it's the fact that it's giving, well, they weren't the first. I mean, it happened in Tunisia, and then I guess Egypt after that, and then even Jordan had some protests. So I think it's major, and I think it's good. I think, though, it's kind of like, okay, well, you got the guy out of there. What are you going to replace him with? I mean, I think there's still a bunch of stuff to work out. But I guess one thing at a time, I guess, right. You know, when they had demonstrations in Iran just on Monday,
yep.
I thought, okay, that's the big one. I thought if that pulls off like the way it should, like that would be, I think that would make Egypt look like a walk in the park because of its hard, their hardliner government and,
right.
You know, I think... To me, I want to see more of that. And I think Egypt paved the way, and hopefully, you know, like, not as many people will die, but, you know, people are dying, like, in Bahrain and places. But I think the real society to change is Iran, in my opinion. The hardliners. Bring down the hardliners. They could really coordinate that. I mean, they had like tens of thousands. If they could get more than that, where even Iran's establishment couldn't stop it, I think that would be pretty major. Yep. That's my whole take on it. I think the big thing is Iran.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You know, and more details about the Middle East than I do, and I have to admit, I don't know enough at all to have an opinion to that degree, because I it's really fascinating because my take has always been, and it's weird because like my mind went to Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan.
Okay.
You're like, what?
Okay.
Well, and basically what happened was about the time when this is all happening, Reagan's anniversary of his 100th birthday, right?
Right.
And on PBS...
I watched it.
They were showing Reagan, right? Yeah. Like I love the American experience whenever they do the anything presidents. About the presidents, right? Like, it's just, I'm riveted.
Yeah, for sure.
And I didn't see all of it, but I caught a glimpse of it. And they were showing this thing about Jimmy Carter as president doing this, you know, address to the nation saying that he was concerned. That America wasn't about freedom, it was about materialism, and capitalism had run amok, and that we had to just rethink about what is that we value as Americans, is what he was basically saying.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's a hard pill to swallow if you're an American who thinks that I should be able to get all the, you know, I should be entrepreneurial and successful, that's part of the American dream, right?
Right.
And of course, that's what was the big difference between when Reagan was running for president. He totally said, well, you know, we could be great again. We are great. You know, American exceptionalism. Like, Carter, you just are a wet blanket, basically,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
and totally. And he went in a landslide and won again in 84, riding that wave of that the economic boom, right? And, mm-hmm. you know, basically saying, look, you know, if you're positive, we are exceptional, and now look, we're all working, right? And, you know, Carter was dealing with the beginnings of a recession and everything, right? So yeah,
that's right.
So it made me think about sort of, I juxtapose that idea when I think about sort of North America today, and America isn't that different from what we're talking about. You know, there's a lot of everyone wants the iPhone 4, everyone wants this, and even I want an iPad, you know, like all these sure. different things, right? And in a lot of discussions, especially post 9/11, blurs democracy with capitalism and freedom with free markets. Like, it's, they're all very different concepts, right? Totally. And not one and the same, right? and so I think about sort of that, plus the fact that there's, like you said, there's, people can't hide anymore. People can't be hidden from what's going on in other parts of the world.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's sort of like these forces are colliding for, I don't know what's good or bad or whatever, but where nerds have finally, you know, outsmarted everyone and made this thing called the internet and access to things like Facebook and Twitter, where governments just can't keep up, right? They can't, sure. they can barely shut it down. They shut down the internet, but Twitter lets you do something via phone to get your tweets out, or that's all the stuff, right? Like it's, you know, nerds are one step ahead and it keeps information flowing. And I wonder what's going to happen in China. I wonder what's going to happen in North Korea, in Iran, and all yeah. these different things, right? Like,
yeah.
And so I think there's, everyone's sort of now understanding what's out there in the world, but what they're seeing is America. And that's the biggest, that's the biggest voice out there, the loudest voice. And, you know, the internet's like, you know, 90% American anyways, I guess, in some senses, right? Or, you know, all in English and that sort of thing. So I think it's going to take generations long after we're all gone.
Yeah.
But, you know, I wonder where the world's going to be, you know, 50 years from now, where I think, you know, people will want democracy, think they want, because they see what's happening in America as freedom, but will, in their local circumstances, maybe based on their local religion or their, you know, religion, not local religious religion, mm-hmm. like maybe they'll interpret it in a different way. And I think,
or America, you know, could learn.
And I think, you know, I think at some point, you know, because there's so much free information, maybe 100 years from now, 1500 years from now, I don't know if it'll be gentrified, but I think there'll be everything will be so mixed up that we'll all be, there'll be one thing, whatever that is. And I think if I'm positive, it'll be the best of everything, right? Like,
yeah.
like America will learn and evolve. You know, democracy in China will learn from their mistakes and try something different, and eventually it will sort of be what it is, you know, and there'll be more understanding because everyone will just know what everyone is doing because you just
can't not know,
right? So, I don't know, so that's where my mind goes, more about sort of information, and then what information do you get drawn to, and how do you take that information and interpret it in your local circumstance, right? So it's more, I guess, maybe sociological reaction that I have.
Yeah.
Than anything else, maybe? I don't know.
No, completely, completely. It's all about that. And I think you're right. Like, I think North Korea would probably be the last country to go that route. But, you know, it's like, that would be the last country to break into, like, information-wise.
Right.
But I think that's exactly the point, is that all these protests and changes of regimes or whatever are just really just a stepping stone for just people just kind of understanding more about how we are. Like, you know, you think of American free market capitalism and this loss of almost like a spiritual kind of inner self, you know? Like we lost, like North America essentially kind of lost its way towards, you know, how we really should be, you know? But then you've got other societies where they feel like they really have that, even though I do think it's like a fake purity. But I mean, even Saddam Hussein wore cowboy hats and watched football. So it's like, you know, there's other societies that want exactly what America's doing, although they'll never admit it. And there's a lot about our societies where we need more of that, more of that so-called purity or moral sense of self, you know? Right. I think if you just take some of those aspects from each, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, we have too much stuff, and it's like, yeah, we probably do, but I don't know, like, a lot of the times, it's like, we need a lot of these things for a reason, right? Like, right. We need cars, I don't know, I just think...
Well, I think there's nothing wrong with stuff, as long as stuff has either a utility...
Yeah.
...or a meaning. Yeah. And I think more so a meaning. Like, I remember, like, when I was emceeing our friend Charles and Cheryl's wedding, and congratulations to them, by the way.
Oh, yes, that's right.
And I remember I said this as part of what I was emceeing, and, you know, I take opportunities to say speeches, I guess. I don't know what it is, but I just remember about sort of, I don't know why I had that thought, I just had to say it, about, you know, like rings, you know, thinking about like the wedding rings or the wedding dress and you know, things you'll wear, you know, I mean, the wedding ring hopefully you'll wear all the time, but the dress you wear the one time or whatever. And yes, there's so much to say about, you know, how much it costs and the ceremony and stuff, but if you choose to put meaning in it, then that dress is value. There is value to it, right?
Yeah.
And it's not, and value is a very individual thing.
Yeah.
Some people want to spend $1,200 or however thousands of dollars on a dress, and some people want to spend nothing.
Yeah.
And both is fine.
Yeah.
But the worst is if you have something and you don't give it any, and it has no value to you.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's the dissonance you don't want.
Yeah.
If you have stuff and it's something or whatever it is and you value it, then that's okay.
Yeah. No, I agree.
You know, I think...
You know, it's good to go Buddhist every now and again and clear out your crap.
It's true.
Anyway, we should move on.
Yes. Actually, one of the things I wanted to... And I have this called Facebook versus email. And the reason why I bring this up, because you were asking me this yesterday, because you've been sending some emails out to a whole bunch of people asking for responses, and I just sent something out yesterday with a whole bunch of, you know, to a whole bunch of people asking for responses, and you asked me, so have you got responses on that sort of stuff? And I was thinking, oh, a few. And then I was thinking about sort of, not Facebook, but just, you know, other things other than email, right?
How to communicate.
How people are communicating these days, and, you know, like I'm on Facebook still just as regularly as I was, you know, first I started using it, right? And I'm having some really great, in-depth, wonderful... That's your phone.
Sorry, I forgot to turn it off.
Oh, we won't edit that out because we want
to... We want to laugh about that.
Yes.
That's so funny.
But anyways, you know, I'm having these really good, great, you know, this great conversation on Facebook, and made me sort of think about sort of, you know, where are people going to get their fix for communication, contact, what have you. And not so much where is it going, but just pondering whether or not emails have sort of, you know, passed its best before date, you know? Because everyone's texting these days, and, you know, and just take out work, you know, because work, I'm always on email, and I think work and email will be there for a long time.
Right.
In much the same way, you know, fax machines were at work for a long time, right? So, like work is a different animal. But when you're thinking about other things, right? Like, yeah, I don't respond to my email. I check it all the time, but I don't respond to things as quickly as I do. As I do with other things like a text.
Or, right.
Or a Facebook email. Or a Twitter, maybe. I don't know. But you know what I mean? And I just started to think about it. I finally starting to feel, when people kept saying, oh, email so passe. And I'm like, you know, to some degree, it may be.
Mm-hmm.
So anyways, I just thought that was an interesting thing that came into my head. And I wondered if you were thinking that too.
Well, I think just normal email, sometimes you can almost think of it as that. But at the same time, it's like, a lot of my Facebook notifications I find in my email. Like,
oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Because I, well, and it's just circumstance of, you know, because I have my email on all the time.
Yeah.
But I first see the, like, any Facebook activity, I have filtering into a certain inbox. So Okay. I see right away if someone's, you know, answering a message that I might have done, like, the email version on Facebook. I'll actually see the message on my Gmail first. Because, yeah, it's kind of weird. Although there's some people I talk almost exclusively on Facebook rather than email.
Right.
And the other way around.
Some people I don't, that's all I have. I don't have an email. I have a Facebook.
Oh, really? Yeah. Yep. Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Oh, there's lots of those too. Yeah. And so, yeah, I don't know. I mean, they were talking to Zuckerberg about if they think that they want to take over email, like basically make email obsolete.
Right.
I saw that on 60 Minutes. And he was kind of cagey. He's like, well, we're not really looking at that now. We're right. not really thinking that along those lines, right?
Right.
But I think if they could, they would. They, to me, the to make email really passé, there would have to be a new system to usurp it that was way better.
You know, you bring up an interesting point, and it reminds me about with technology, there's so many options and so many different ways of engaging with it that in some ways, even a statement like is X passé when you're talking about technology.
Yeah.
You know, at least telecommunications. I mean, CDs in general are starting to be obsolete. God, crazy, but true. So that's a different thing. But when we're talking about like emails, Twitter, Facebooks, or whatever, there's so many different ways that those either get funneled together into one place, or there's so many options that the way I interact with my media is very different than the way you interact in your mediums. I don't have any notifications on Facebook going into my email.
Oh,
I
really?
Shut that all off. I get the occasional one, and I'm surprised because I'm like, that's crazy.
You're connected online, though, on your phone, right?
Yes.
And I'm not.
Yes.
So that could be partly why.
And that's another difference, right? Some people are and some people aren't.
I'm one of the few that are still not.
And, you know, and, well, I mean, I'm one of my three devices.
Wow.
But, awesome. You know, and so because I don't have notification, I check it on my iPod more often, or I log into the facebook.com website more often than yeah. probably other people do who get notifications and can see it right there, right? So it's a it's just a so your my question to you uh-huh. ends up answering a whole different question, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's
no that is interesting.
That's the whole point. I wanted to sort of ask that.
No, that's cool. That's cool.
The last couple of things were George Shearing.
George Shearing, yeah.
I was so sad.
I couldn't believe it. I don't know. I think it was your Facebook post that I was like, no way. And I thought, okay, yeah, 91. Okay.
Yeah.
That's what happens, right?
Yeah.
You die. But it's funny because, I mean, I love his music. That night when I saw that and I went to bed, I actually played on my iPod, I played his album, My Favorite Things, which I really love it because I've always liked jazz guys that know how to play the classics, like classical
right.
style.
Right.
It's they bring a certain, I mean, I think most jazz guys can anyway. But him and Bill Evans and others that could really do it, Herbie Hancock, they bring a certain elegance to their jazz playing. And it's just solo piano, as you know. And I just thought, I almost forgot about that record briefly. And when you posted that, I was like, oh, you know, I mean, it's sad, of course, because he's one of the old guys, right? Mm-hmm. You know, another one gone. And
yeah.
And I think, you know, it was so great that we got to see him. I wouldn't have ever seen him if it wasn't for you. I think you're the one that turned me on to him. I don't think I would have known who he was.
Mm.
So it was obviously a privilege to see him, you know, when we did.
It's funny because one of my first ever eBay purchases were four George Shearing Quintet albums. I got them off of eBay.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
like CD or vinyl?
Vinyl.
Yeah, because I bought a few at a record swap a year or two ago. I bought like four of them. Because some guy had this big George Shearing pile. Have I even showed you them?
No.
Okay, well, next time you come over. It's great. They're from like 70s, 60s. Right. Some live, some studio. Yeah. And they're great.
So I got some Quintet stuff, and it's like from when he was doing some more Latin stuff, right?
Yes,
and,
same. Yeah.
And I listened to a few of them, and sometimes they're a bit cheesy, but they're of the day. But they're just, I just love the Quintet piece, the sound, right? Cool. And, but I think back to that concert we went to at the Orpheum, which was, you know, George Shearing and I think Don Thompson was the bassist, just piano. Because after he stopped doing the Quintet, he basically did solo piano, a little bit of trio stuff, but he really loved the piano bass. And I remember when he was coming to the Orpheum that I wanted him to so come with the Quintet, because he had released a studio album of the Quintet. You know, that Shearing sound, it was called. And yeah. I'm like, great, he's going to come back with the Quintet. But he came back with just the duo.
Yeah.
And he was opening up for, or sorry, Dinah Krall was opening up for him. Which is cool. And I think there's about 8 of us who all went, and I, you know, let's just go. And I remember being a bit nervous because, you know, like, I think about people, you know, who go to see jazz stuff, and they kind of want someone with a lyricist so they can actually, you know, hear a singer.
Oh, I know.
You know, and I was like, oh, well, Dinah Krall's there, but will they like the second half? And,
yeah.
And I was a bit disappointed. I wasn't quite sure if I was going to like the second half either. Although I loved George Shearing, but I was kind of disappointed with the Quintet.
Yeah.
And then I was just floored. It was probably one of the best concerts, at least jazz concerts, that I've ever been to. And that's why I put my Facebook status when he did pass away, that little thing, because I really wanted him. Like, the best song, I still remember it. Mm-hmm. It just piano and bass, that Sunday, that summer, that old classic Nat King Cole song.
Mm-hmm.
So beautiful. Like, I was probably almost in tears listening to how beautiful that was at that concert. And I swear, I kept hoping that he would come up with an album that had that in it for piano and bass. Never came out. I've never seen it. And I mean, maybe he's come up with some albums that I just never noticed because I stopped following as closely as I did. But he did do a live Quintet album, and they had that song on there.
Oh.
But it was the Quintet.
So it didn't have the...
Didn't have the same oomph to it.
Sure.
But is there something that simplicity, the softness? The Quintet is more about sound and that block sound and that volume to it, even though it can be very quiet. But for that song, and that's just the way I heard it in the Orpheum, I was just stunned.
Nice.
And, maybe there's like a lost recording somewhere out there. I don't know.
Oh, I'm sure.
Like, we'll see.
I'm sure. That's fascinating. That's cool. Yeah, he was amazing.
But yeah, I think that's about it. There's one other topic, but I am deciding not. I will edit it out and not mention it because it's hard to mention. Because I actually want your reaction to it.
Okay.
But it's kind of something that I have to show you, and then we have to talk about it. It just doesn't translate well on a podcast. No video. But I'll show it to you later.
Okay.
But yeah, so I think we're pretty good. We're at 52 minutes. So
yeah, we need to chow.
Yes, because we're all. Oh my God! It's almost 9 o'clock.
It's almost 9.
Okay, let's go eat.
We're going out on the down now.
It's guys' night out. Duo. I was chatting with Shalsha on Facebook a little bit, and I told her that the two of us were going out. And I said, we're going to go paint the town bland. I said.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Okay.
Yeah. All right.
That was good. This is a good one.
Really good. That was some really good topics you had down there. I like how sometimes I'll have some stuff, you'll have some stuff written down. Like, I came with nothing. I knew we'd talk about Egypt, but that was...
And this is the first time in weeks or in podcasts that I've actually had a list, so I feel good.
That's right. Yeah. And thanks for bringing up Oda, because... Yeah, we're just going to go.
Okay, till next time.
See ya.